Join me. You may be able to help solve a mystery.
Hello, friends.
Hi.
Welcome to another episode of You Solved a Mystery, a podcast where we delve into segments of the iconic unsolved mysteries that have been solved and reveal the final chapter. I'm Athena.
And I'm Chandra. And if we sound exactly the same, it's because we're twins.
Chandra.
Athena.
Guess what?
What?
It's our 10th episode.
Oh, wow.
That's kind of a milestone. So in honor of it being our 10th episode, I wanted to do something a little bit special. So I've bent the rules a little bit so that we can work in a topic that is many people's favorite part of Unsolved Mysteries. The supernatural. So I stand firmly that there's not conclusive proof that the supernatural, be it ghosts, aliens, cryptids, psychics, whatever, exist. I'm willing to change my mind should such evidence ever be presented. But for now, it remains an unsolved mystery. But because this segment did include cases that are solved, I figured, in honor of this being our 10th episode, let's dive in. Let's talk about something new. Let's talk about the unexplained.
Okay. I mean, watching this episode, I didn't know what angle you were going to be coming at this from, but the angle that I wound up taking as I was watching was a hard skeptic. So I hope that I'm not going to be too much of a joyless buzzkill here.
I, too, am a skeptic. So I'm trying to come at this from intermediary position. I'm not trying to make any final statements today. That's not my goal. I'm just going to present to you the facts as I know them, as I have found them to be through my research.
Very responsible of you.
The use of psychics by police has always been controversial. Psychics can prove to be misleading, inaccurate, and, at their worst, charlatans. But every once in a while, one comes along who seems to have a gift that is, itself, an unsolved mystery. One such psychic, some argue, was Dorothy Allison. Dorothy Allison was featured in Special Number 6, which originally aired on May 6, 1988, and was reworked into the first season. On YouTube, you can find it in Season 1, Episode 15. Dorothy Allison was born in Jersey City, New Jersey, in 1924. She was one of 13 children.
That is a lot of kids.
A lot of children.
Holy moly.
According to the LA Times, when she was a child, neighbors thought she was a witch. At age 14, she said she had a vision of her father's death, and a few weeks later, he died of pneumonia.
Okay, well, so far, I like her.
You gotta support the witches, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was around the time that she concluded that she was a psychic. Her mother, who she described as also being a seer, told her that her visions were a gift and should never be used for profit. Her psychic tendencies became public in 1968, when a missing boy was found drowned. The year before, Dorothy had gone to Nutley Police and described the boy exactly, down to the fact that his shoes were on the wrong feet. Throughout her career, Dorothy was very public about not understanding her quote-unquote gift. She was quoted in a 1996 book about psychics as saying, quote, "Clairvoyance, telepathy, and extrasensory perception aren't words I use to describe what I do, because I don't know anything about those. It's just natural for me to see a kaleidoscope of pictures in my mind," end quote. According to the LA Times, Dorothy wore a medallion of St. Anthony, the patron saint of lost things, and slept with pictures of the missing children in her cases, who she called her little angels, stating they helped her visualize locations of bodies and suspects. In the segment on Unsolved Mysteries, we actually see her looking through a photo album packed full of pictures of missing children. Dorothy never accepted payment for her psychic work. She detested psychics who charged for their work, saying, quote, those 1-900 number people should be arrested, end quote. But she did accept payment for travel and expenses. She also charged for her appearance on talk shows and public appearances and wrote books and articles, the most successful of which was A Psychic Story, published in 1980. As a side note, Dorothy Allison, A Psychic Story, first edition mass market paperback, is no longer in print, but can be found on Amazon for $47.23 for a used copy, or $920.99 brand new.
Wow. Well, she's doing well in the afterlife.
Good for her. According to the New York Times, there were inferences that she lived large while traveling for work, and it seemed to me they were accusing her of taking advantage of who or what was funding her. One critic, an Atlanta police detective who worked with her, described her as something derogative, so fuck him for that, but said, quote, she rode around in a big limousine, ate real well for 3 days, and then went home, end quote.
Okay, well, I'm glad somebody said something. I mean, not that guy, but I'm glad that this is information that you brought forward, because I was sitting here wondering, like, she got to travel the world for free? Like,
she had her supporters, but she definitely had her critics as well. She had been called to Atlanta to assist the police in the murders of several Black children.
Oh, the Atlanta child murders?
Yeah. And she provided 42 possible names of the suspect, none of which were the man they arrested, tried, and convicted. As I was searching for information about Dorothy Allison, I found an interesting theory in a very short post on the website for the Cropsey documentary, where an anonymous writer posited that they thought she might have been the archetype for the clairvoyant in Poltergeist. At 5 feet 2 inches, Dorothy herself was a very small woman, rudely described by the LA Times as diminutive, and the writer makes the point that the film was written in the 80s when Dorothy was the most active. So I thought that was interesting. Other than her psychic detective work, Dorothy lived a quiet life in Nutley, New Jersey. The New York Times described Chief Robert DeLitta of the Nutley Police Department as, quote, something of a booking agent for her. He was a firm believer in her abilities, saying, quote, the information she provided was very, very accurate, right on the money, end quote. He also said, quote, I know there are a lot of fakes and charlatans out there who prey on the personal loss of an individual, but in Dorothy's case, I really felt that she had the gift, end quote. Dorothy's first ever case was featured on Unsolved Mysteries. On December 3rd, 1967, 5-year-old Michael Kursix went out to play with his brother in a park in Nutley. As they were playing, Michael lost his footing and fell into the river, where he was swept away and sadly drowned. Police searched for his body, but could not find it.
So maybe this is just a matter of semantics, but I had an issue with the way the episode presented this, because they were like, this kid got swept away and drowned, and then it took them a while to find the body. So it's like, you can't tell me that he drowned before you found the body.
Yeah, that's fair. I think maybe they just figured he was such a little boy, and it was cold out, and for him to fall into a river and get swept away, they were just... assuming the worst.
I feel like the way that they set me up to hear it is that it's possible that... I just feel like the way they set it up caused me to become suspicious of someone going around having a lot of information about a couple drownings.
Are we getting into conspiracy theory territory here?
Yes.
2 hours before Michael fell into the river, at 5:56 a.m., Dorothy Allison woke from a nightmare. She had seen a little boy in a pipe with his hands clasped together in front of him and blackened with an illumination of light as though he were in a vacuum. A month later, she went to the police, insisting they listen. So this is a month of them not being able to find Michael's body. A Nutley police sergeant, who doesn't have a lower third in the episode, so I couldn't quite catch his last name, but it's something like Sergeant Don Fukaris, took her statement and was stunned to hear her describe Michael's clothes exactly.
But that's another thing that was ambiguous to me. Did his parents describe to the detectives what he was wearing down to a T?
I'm sure they did. They wanted him to be found. Isn't that the first thing that parents tell the police when they want their child to be found?
Or did she already know where he was and she had seen his clothes firsthand?
No, I don't think so. I'm going to go with no on that one. Dorothy described that he was wearing a green snowsuit, a striped polo shirt, an undershirt with a metal pin to it, and his shoes on the wrong feet.
The saddest detail to me was his shoes on the wrong feet. Just a little 5-year-old running out into the cold to go play. And he's so excited he puts his shoes on the wrong feet. It's so
makes it
sad.
Feel very, very real. Yeah. Dorothy saw or sensed the numbers 120 and 8, gold lettering on a window, an ITT factory, the back of a school, and lumber. The police thought the numbers could be an address, but they didn't find anything applicable in the search area. They thought maybe it was a date, 120, but January 20th came and went, and the police started to lose their patience. So Dorothy told them he'd be found February 7th, and their troubles would be over. On February 7th, at 1:20 p.m., Sergeant Brooks was informed Michael's body had been found. It's contested in articles whether he was actually in a pipe, as Dorothy saw, but a man searching for a place to bury his deceased pet cat found the body in Clifton, New Jersey, 2 months after the tragic accident.
But did they ever ask him if a small lady had suggested a burial site to him?
Are you going to spend this entire episode trying to make the argument that she was a serial killer?
Maybe.
Oh, no. Nearby along the river where Michael was found was elementary school PS 8. There was a lumber yard across the street, next door to an office with gold lettering on the window. Across the river was an ITT factory, and though Michael's galoshes were on the correct feet, it was found that his undershoes were swapped. Upon backtracking, Sergeant Don felt the pieces fell together like a puzzle. In the next case, Unsolved Mysteries featured, on December 20th, 1974, a banker named John DeMars left his Manhattan office to catch the train home to New Jersey. He was a happily married man with 2 children and habitually called home if he was going to be late. But that night, when his train arrived in Nutley, he wasn't aboard. Initially, police thought that he might have embezzled money and disappeared, or had had an affair and ran off for a new life, but found that neither theory was accurate.
If he was the man in most of our other episodes, that would have been accurate.
But sadly, he was actually a happily married man who probably loved his children. Detective Sal Liberace of the Nutley Police went to Dorothy for help. She immediately said John had drowned and was in the water.
Another drowning? Coincidence?
She saw a row of tires, a park with a place for sledding, and a fire engine that children played on, the number 222, and a bow and arrow. Police didn't really know what to make of this. How would a man on a train wind up drowning between stops? But 2 months after he disappeared, a father and son were shooting targets with bow and arrows by the Passaic River. An arrow missed its mark and landed a few feet from the body of John DeMars. It was February 22nd, 2:22. Nearby, in a park, a row of tires were set up to form a sled run. Police developed a theory, in this case, that John fell asleep on the train. It made an unscheduled stop while on the Passaic River Bridge, and the conductor opened the doors to let a passenger off in the back. Still half asleep and thinking they'd reached Nutley, John exited the train and fell to the river below.
I just want to understand why nobody was paying attention in this theory. Like, why was there nobody standing by this door? It just seems like someone should have been standing at this door, making sure that it closed properly and was secured.
Well, it's just a commuter train. It's a train people are on and off every day. And this was 1974. I hope nowadays they don't make unscheduled stops where they open the doors on a bridge. But in 1974, I don't know.
It's horrible.
It is.
So the thing with both of those cases is that she didn't actually help them find the people. They just found clues to connect to the things that she said after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
But what I will give her is it would be very hard to stage the father-son archery thing. So there's that. Either she was a mastermind or...
1 point against the serial killer theory. All right.
Possible coincidence.
Mm-hmm. At this point in the segment, we meet Ellen Jacobson, who says she doesn't know how Dorothy Allison's mind works, but, quote, "If Dorothy told me, Ellen, go outside and cross the street, I'd go outside and cross the street," end quote. Ellen and her husband, Bill, met Dorothy after their 14-year-old daughter, Susan, left home for an interview at an ice cream shop and never returned. It was May 15th, 1976. They went to the police, but were told that their daughter was a runaway, had run off with her boyfriend, and they didn't have the manpower to search for runaways.
Garbage.
Yeah, we hear it too often. Ellen and Bill contacted Dorothy for help, and she traveled to Staten Island. The first thing she asked was, "What does 2562 mean?" Ellen said it was Susan's birthday. She asked, "What does 408 or 405 mean?" Ellen said it was the time Susan was born. Then she asked about M.A.R. She said she saw M.A.R. in red letters and they should go to the police because Susan had been murdered, strangled by her boyfriend. The police refused to listen or to work with a psychic, so Bill took the investigation upon himself. In addition to M.A.R., Dorothy saw an abandoned car, the smell of oil, two sets of church steeples, smokestacks, swamps, and marshes. Bill's search brought him to an abandoned World War I shipyard in Downback, where he found a concrete structure with M.A.R. spray-painted in red. He brought Dorothy there to search, and she was sure it was the right place, but the police still would not listen and would not search. So Bill and Dorothy searched the best they could, but they didn't find Susan. It was 22 months later that three boys who were muskrat hunting... What? Muskrat hunting?
That sounds like hitting something with a stick.
Yeah. Shooting slingshots at animals for fun or something. I don't get it. But these three boys were muskrat hunting, and they came across Susan's body. She had been strangled and stashed in two oil drums.
I don't like the implication of two oil drums.
It's never good when one body is in two oil drums. The oil drums were 100 yards from the letters M-A-R. They smelled of oil. And from the swampy spot where her body was found, you could see church steeples, smokestacks, an abandoned car, and the concrete structure.
Okay, when she rattled off the numbers, I was like, she could have looked up a birth certificate.
Yeah.
But the M.A.R. thing, that was pretty specific, and I was surprised when they found an M.A.R.
Yeah, that's a pretty wild coincidence.
On the other hand, what it is. There were 22 months in which she could have spray-painted the M.A.R. and stashed the body.
You know, I did have the thought that if this was a public thing, if this was made public, that she had seen MAR and then an MAR was found, someone could have moved the body to that location to make it work. Maybe not Dorothy, but could have been someone else if it was public information. But Susan's boyfriend, Dempsey Hawkins, was arrested and convicted of the murder. And just as Dorothy had said, her boyfriend had strangled her. He was sentenced to 22 years to life in prison, and in 2017, he was paroled and deported to England. After showcasing these cases that Dorothy had aided with, Unsolved Mysteries decided to give her the task of solving another case without allowing her to have any info about the victim beforehand. Unsolved Mysteries found an unsolved homicide in Hagerstown, Maryland, where the police agreed to consult with Dorothy and let Unsolved Mysteries film her process. They told Dorothy nothing about the case. Sergeant Keith Wattenschat from the Maryland Police contacted Dorothy over the phone. She told him, "You're looking for a janitor who works in a school." She sensed it was an abduction or kidnapping. She felt the suspect had suicidal tendencies and something wrong with his feet. She saw the numbers 1 and 7. She saw a police officer who dressed in a disguise, wore glasses and a wig, and took off a beard to change his appearance. What struck Sergeant Wattenschat was that he was a plainclothes police officer who had just returned from vacation and had to shave off his beard, and he wore a hairpiece, and a quality one, I might add. It looked very natural.
That part made me lol.
He felt that she could be zeroing in on him without having ever met him. He told Unsolved Mysteries that he usually would not work with a psychic, but he was keeping an open mind because that's how much he wanted to solve this case. It had been 4 years since 15-year-old Lorraine Lori Zimmerman was murdered. She'd left her aunt's house one day in April of 1984 to head home and seemingly vanished. Her mother went to police immediately, insisting that something was wrong. 8 days later, Lori's body was found partially naked in the woods. She had been beaten and suffocated.
Initially, I was wondering how this case was going to be different from the previous one, because in that case, the police refused to investigate.
Refused to work with Dorothy?
No, they refused to investigate, period.
Oh, right. They just said she was
Susan
a runaway.
Jacobson.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
So I was wondering how it was going to be different that a teenage girl had gone missing. Then I realized it's because her body was found much sooner, and I was disappointed in two different directions, both that the police won't investigate girls that they call runaways, and also that girls get murdered so often.
A 1984 article in the Baltimore Sun suggested that, had Lori's case been taken more seriously from the start, it might have had different results. Her case joined a host of others as an example of changes that needed to be made in responding to cases of missing children. Lori was initially viewed the same as hundreds of other teens reported missing, including Susan, and it's something true crime fans are all too familiar with. A runaway, who would return home eventually. Lori was described by her mother, Sandra Long, as being a little slower to mature, more of a homebody, and so innocent that Sandra still read her bedtime stories at night. The police took a little information about Lori, but failed to complete the report, and neglected to send it to the FBI or start an investigation after their mandatory 24-hour waiting period. They finally took a formal report from Sandra after Lori had already been missing for 48 hours. They also told the local news station, whom Sandra had contacted, not to run a story about Lori because they said Lori had run away before, had problems at home, and was a street kid. None of which was true. After the fact, a lieutenant told the Baltimore Sun, quote, "Unfortunately, we had no way of knowing ahead of time that she would turn up. A homicide."
Oh, gee. How unfortunate. You couldn't possibly have considered doing your job.
That's why you investigate!
I am so frustrated right now.
Yes, Lori's case is absolutely infuriating.
And so is Susan's.
Yeah. A local paper finally ran a story on Lori on the 13th, but it was too late. Her body was found the next day.
That's just, like, it seems so hateful to be like, go to the news and say, don't report on this. Mm-hmm. We don't want you to care about this child that is not with her family.
Mm-hmm. It seems so intentionally
cruel.
Yeah, derailing. Evidently, time of death was not very sophisticated at the time, because they couldn't pin down an exact time or day that Lori had died. So it's possible that she was already deceased before her mom even knew that she was missing. But she also might not have been. Had the police asked around and looked for people who saw her that day, it's possible that she could have been saved. This was 4 years after the very, very public and infamous kidnapping and murder of Adam Walsh. So it was during a time when there was a lot of criticism around the way police approached cases of missing children, and it added more fuel to the fire that was aimed at changing police practices when it came to looking into missing children. So in that way, Lori has a bit of a legacy. Dorothy flew to Hagerstown, where Sergeant Wattenstadt met her at the airport. As he introduced himself, "Hi, I'm Sergeant Wattenstadt," she said, "I know." To which I say, "Calm down, Dorothy. We get it. You're psychic." As they drove through town, retracing Lori's possible last steps, not wearing seatbelts, by the way. I'm not even sure that car had seatbelts, and it was stressing me out. Still without having been told anything about the case, Dorothy started rattling off visions and senses. She gave the name of a suspect, which they bleeped out in the show out of caution. She got the name Chuck and either Goldstein or Bernstein. She felt that Lori had walked as far as the library, where she met two friends. She saw an old yellow car and the name Cleveland. She believed Lori had been raped and then murdered. She saw something wrong with her head, as if she'd been hit, felt an enormous heat around her, and felt a suffocating sensation, not as if being strangled, but as if there was something in the throat. This is what shook Sergeant Wattenstadt the most, as they had never released to the public that Lori had asphyxiated on a plastic bag that had been forced into her mouth and lodged in her throat. There was no way for Dorothy to know that.
I feel like I'm a little bit jaded by all of the exposure to true crime and horror movies I've put myself through. But then sometimes there are details that I wish I hadn't learned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in researching these stories, I feel I get to that point sometimes of, oh, listening is one thing, but when you actually research it, you find all the details that other people choose to leave out when they're sharing the story. Dorothy wound up coming up with 50 clues in Lori's case. And while some of them felt misplaced, such as the disguised policeman being Sergeant Wattenstadt, and the janitor perhaps referring to Lori's stepfather, who was a janitor at the school, others seemed right on target. There was the foreign object in her throat and suffocation. There was the sensation that something was wrong with the head. Lori's jaw had been broken. Dorothy had seen the name Cleveland, and the last road sign before the location where Lori's body was found was Cleveland Town Road. This could absolutely be a coincidence. Or if you're a believer, it could be pieces of a picture falling together. At the crime scene, Dorothy said she was positive the censored name was their guy and that they should start looking for him right away. However, they ran the name through a computer and no such person could be found. To be devil's advocate, there are pseudonyms. We've encountered them a lot in this podcast.
Also, I'm sure that their 1980s computer didn't have the names of every single person.
Right. They ran his name through the computer, and 10 billion hours later, they got their results. devastatingly, Lori's case remains unsolved.
No, I thought that was going to be the solved mystery.
No, it's the other three.
No, Athena.
Although DNA was collected from the crime scene, the samples were compromised, possibly due to inefficient collecting methods, because in the 1980s, they really didn't understand DNA yet, which makes testing complicated and not so successful. But Sergeant David Sexton does continue to follow leads and seek DNA testing in Lori's case in the hope that they will find the answer someday. Now that Chandra's looking at me, just completely devastated and disappointed, here are some other notable cases that Dorothy Ellison worked on. One was Patty Hearst, who was abducted by the Symbionese Liberation Army. In 1974, her father, Randolph Hearst, contacted her for help finding Patty. She could not locate Patty, but said she felt she had spent time in Pennsylvania and New York City, which both turned out to be true. The SLA had spent time both places, and she predicted that Patty would wind up assisting her captors in robbing a bank, which also famously, or infamously, came true.
To continue my conspiracy theory, maybe Dorothy was a part of the
Symbionese Liberation Army. She was a far-right radical, or the far-left radicals. I don't know. They're radicals who killed people. Randolph Hearst later said, quote, "Dorothy couldn't locate Patty, but she is honest and reputable. I wouldn't laugh at it," end quote. Dorothy was also credited with giving an accurate description of the Son of Sam killer to a police artist and correctly predicting that he would be picked up on a traffic violation. David Berkowitz, the chaotic serial killer that terrorized New York, was caught after receiving a parking ticket. The New York Press quoted Chief DeLitta of Nutley talking about a 1993 homicide where he was present while Dorothy was interviewed by the police. He said she accurately supplied the information that they would have to pass a produce market to get to the suspect's house, that he lived on a street with a double letter in it, and that his last name had a double letter in it. She said the headlight was out on his car and that the weapon would be found in a river. When the suspect was apprehended a year later, these were found to be true. However, this seems to be the exact situation magician and infamous debunker James Randi was referring to when he told the New York Press, quote, "I spoke with so many detectives in so many towns all over the U.S. who said she came in, sat with them for 2 or 3 hours and said things like, 'There's a red color here. I get a double initial, like an R or a B. Also, there's water, flowing water. And rain, I get rain. And newspaper. And the smell of oil or gasoline. Oh, it's very strong. And I see a small car, a light-colored car, somehow involved. And it goes on, with all this generalization. It's a case of giving a tremendous amount of data and hoping that some of it will prove to have some relationship to reality." End quote. So if you think about the Atlanta child murders, she threw out 42 names. In Lori's case, she threw out 50 clues.
Yeah, that's actually something I was wondering when they were talking about the number of clues in Lori's cases, if she just rambled off anything that could be related to anybody parallel to the case, then she could have actually known some things, just random things she was able to figure out and then repeated them.
Mm-hmm.
Or she could have just been throwing out random ideas. Or if you're a believer, maybe she sensed them.
I forgot to say that so Dorothy had gotten the sense of the letters 1 and 7. She didn't know if it was 17 or 71 or what that meant in Lori's case. And it turned out Lori Zimmerman was buried in cemetery plot number 17. But what if she'd come up with the number 52? Maybe that would have been the number school bus that Lori took that day. If you throw out enough numbers,
eventually one of them is going to be right.
Mm-hmm.
But all of my conspiracy theorying aside, she does sound like she was really actually a nice lady who didn't take advantage of people financially, at least.
I think she had good intentions.
Tried to give people help and closure. and occasionally lived it up on the police's dime. And it's not like they were using that budget to look for young missing girls, so why not?
I guess. Yeah. Joe Nickel, a regular contributor to Skeptical Inquirer, calls the trick that psychic detectives use retrofitting. When retrofitting, the psychic tosses out several clues, like numbers or a mention of water, that can be interpreted to fit the facts after the case is solved. He said, quote, "Certainly, Dorothy Allison caused a great deal of, I'm sure, unintended mischief," end quote. Some of Dorothy's better-known failures were the Atlanta child murders, where about a dozen black children had been murdered between 1979 and 1980, and she gave 42 possible names, none of which matched the killer. In 1979, a New Jersey detective called her a fraud for wrongly claiming credit for leading the police to a body of an 8-year-old boy who had been strangled, stating she'd done it to promote her new book. He said all she had done was send policemen and bloodhounds on a wild goose chase and gave up when nothing was found. The case was solved by a witness who saw the suspect and boy together. To her credit, Dorothy herself was not too proud to admit that it didn't always work. In the Unsolved Mysteries segment, Dorothy admits that there are times when she really wanted to help, but just completely struck out. Sometimes, nothing would come to her. Dorothy claimed to have assisted in more than 5,000 cases around the globe and was credited by many with helping to solve more than a dozen murders and find at least 50 missing children.
If it's true, I like it. I'm for it.
Absolutely. It is disputed, of course. Author Michael Dennett, who wrote about her in a chapter of his book Psychic Sleuths, ESP, and Sensational Cases, said, quote, "Her success rate in solving crimes or in finding bodies is very close to, if not actually, zero." But still, she had a wall in her home full of framed citations from thankful police departments. Dorothy spent over 30 years of her life helping police and families search for their missing loved ones and find possible suspects. She had a desire to help, to find the answers that would bring closure or peace or a new chapter to hurting families. But she told Unsolved Mysteries, quote, "I've often thought to myself, why does this happen to me? Why not somebody else? Because it has been very hard on me emotionally, physically, and has not been a happy thing for me at all times," end quote. In 1990, Dorothy Allison told her family she would not live to be 75. She passed away from heart failure on December 1st, 1999, 4 weeks from her 75th birthday. And that's the story of witch, seer, psychic, Dorothy Allison.
Her predicting her own death is just too good for me to even comment on.
It does give you chills. Like we said, we are skeptics, but I'm really glad to have found a way to work in a little bit of the paranormal. And I hope to find other ways to work it in down the line, because it's so fun. Skeptic or not, I love the supernatural.
It is most of the non-true crime media that we consume.
Yeah. And I really do think that Dorothy Allison meant well, be she psychic or not.
And I really hope that they're able to find out what happened to Lori someday.
Yeah.
Maybe the next psychic detective.
Well, thank you again for joining us.
If you enjoyed what you heard, you can link up with us on Instagram at You Solved Mystery. You can also email us your thoughts and constructive criticisms and suggestions at yousolvedamystery@gmail.com.
We'd love to hear from you. If you'd be ever so kind, it would be so helpful if you would leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and maybe share us with a friend. We're having a lot of fun doing this. We're having a lot of fun sharing it with you, and we hope you're having a lot of fun listening. As always, I'm Athena.
And I'm Chandra.
Join us next time for for another episode of You Saw a Mystery.